Hi everyone, my name is Toni Lashton. I am Belarusian queer feminist activist who has been born and raised in Minsk. And today I'm sitting in Warsaw with a very dear friend of mine, Andrei Zabalei. Hi Andrei.
Hello everybody. It's quite thrilling and exciting, and at the same time it feels a little bit nervous to speak in English, even though I think it's important and quite meaningful to express my own thoughts and ideas. And that's what we both are doing in our work.
Yep.
And we are writing, we are talking, we are thinking. And I was quite often faced with the fact the European, the Western societies know almost nothing about Belarus and about queer people in Belarus and the context as such of my own country. And thus we had an idea together with Toni to have this very short introduction into Belarusian context of queer and non-queer existence, even though I think we can only refer to the queer one.
Yeah, that's true. I also feel that it is quite peculiar for me to talk in English about all of that. I think most of my experience connected to talking in English about, you know, how was it like growing up as a queer person in Belarus, like how my experience of, as a non-binary individual is connected to the realities of Belarus. Most of those were interviews by people who, for example, would come from the US or, I don't know, Poland, Sweden, you know, the countries of the global north. And then they would decide what to ask, and typically I didn't have any type of power to either rephrase the questions or, you know, pose the questions I felt were important to talk about the realities of Belarus. And I think when Andrei and I have talked about, you know, this podcast and this episode of the podcast, we thought that it would be very interesting to see what type of questions we would ask ourselves if we finally have this opportunity to talk about Belarus and LGBTQ people in Belarus on our own terms.
The most problematic part is to explain yourself to the interviewer. There is a huge background information which is not clear for even professional journalists in the West, so to speak. And at the same time, I felt quite often like ashamed for this very uncomfortable situation of, like, there is a need to express yourself and there is a frame being produced for you, and in this very frame you are either a victim or a hero, or I don't know, both.
Yeah, or both. Exactly. Or both at the same time. Yep.
And I was just there like, hello, I'm neither hero nor victim, even though I struggled with a lot of shit in my life, and I think I won quite a lot of fights in my life, which basically technically makes me also a little bit of a hero. I just would like us, Toni, in this very conversation to just reflect on those issues we are having in our experiences, and just to be just easygoing and flexible about it, and just to share these thoughts in a very natural way. And just maybe for starters, I might say a few words about the position of my country on the global arena of political, economical, post-colonial world, or neo-colonial, right? The point is, Belarus is stuck in between of two zones of influences. It's like the Cold War have never ended, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a very unique state of mind, of existence, in which you are thrown in between two. It's a very binary system. Like, if you are homosexual, for instance, you are being put into a frame of European values. And if you are opposing those values, you are automatically being put into the Russian influence area. But the truth is, the reality is much more complex and much more colorful, so to speak. For instance, our criminal president, how it's called, illegal ruler of the country, of the Republic of Belarus. Just recently, he gave a press conference, many millions of press conference he's given. He likes to speak so much, and then a lot of even independent media give him a lot of coverage for his stupid ideas. But he did actually really something smart just a few weeks ago, answering the question about the necessity of prohibiting homosexual propaganda in Belarus, besides of other stupid things that he said. He did a very smart move by admitting the fact there actually are a lot of homosexual people in the administration, his own administration, his own structures and system he created and his followers. And he also referred to those gay, mostly men. So at first he said it's disgusting and it's terrible and it's beyond his own values and so on and so forth. And then he said, you know, I looked through all the dossiers, all the information about these specific employees, and I was shocked to find out all of them are brilliant employees. All of them are just very, very loyal and productive and effective. And he even said that, oh, I wish all the heterosexual men would work like this. So this very example for me is astonishing in this regard. Like, how can be obviously homophobic totalitarian leader, I mean, a criminal, be as smart as to provide to the homosexual citizens of the country a very clear paternalistic proposal? If you are loyal, I will not put any pressure on you. You are a valuable part of the system. Just behave nicely, like don't try to make this propaganda, blah, 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 and you will have a decent life. Isn't it smart? I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah, but I think like if we have a little bit deep reflections on, you know, why that was done and how this now will be used by this man in power who are surrounding him, I think more or less this is like a trick when he says like, well, some of you are homosexuals and now you can start, you know, point fingers to each other. Who is a homosexual? And then I think the risk of being outed now is so high, it's basically saying to people, the second you think about being unloyal to the so-called president, you will be outed. And then your whole career and your whole life and the information about your sexuality, all of that will be leaked immediately. And we have seen what already happened to people who were like forcefully outed in Belarus. Like, they have been harassed, they have been prosecuted, they have penalized on so many occasions. It's really complex when you start thinking about, you know, how issues of, for example, homosexuality or like having a lesbian identity have been thought through in Belarus. So on the one hand, we have this very patriarchal, extremely conservative person in power who always approached issues of sexuality as gender as, you know, non-important or something that is really of no interest to the state in the country. However, on the other hand, the whole discourse around these issues has been very much formed by this extremely ignorant, I would say, remarks about sexuality and gender and identity and so on. I typically say in the interview, so you have to understand that in Belarus you're not prosecuted because you are an LGBTQ people. It's only one of the vulnerabilities that you have, which will make your life much worse. Typically, you would be prosecuted for your, you know, active social stance on a variety of issues or political activism or civil rights activism. So things that are more connected with shackling the status quo of Belarus. And then you potentially have the opportunity of being prosecuted as an LGBTQ individual. But that is never the, you know, the first thing that is under the attack. And I think because of that, many people think, well, it's quite safe for LGBTQ people in Belarus. Like, it's okay, it's fine. But then you have to understand that you constantly live in this context where you are only as safe as non-political you are. And the second you become more political, like your whole life becomes under the threat.
Yeah, and exactly, I was just trying to present a little bit of a contradictory and comprehensive system which has been produced in Belarus. And this is one of the very unique examples of implementation of divide and conquer strategy. I mean, the totalitarian anti-utopia you can imagine, following George Orwell, for instance, is actually happening, and it's happening for at least 27 years. Just to continue a little bit further about this dissonance between the reality and the policies of the state, exactly, in Belarus there is no such a legal definition as gay propaganda, like in Russia, for instance. Putin introduced it exactly to create a boundary for himself of this values that he's on the forefront of fights, for his whatever patriarchal values there. And in case of Belarus, there is no such a law. There is no legal grounds for prohibiting anything on the topic of homosexuality. And at the same time, they are using this influence of Russia as a legitimization of doing the practice. So there is no legal grounds, but the practice on the ground is actually the same. And exactly this divide and conquer proposal for paternalistic thinking is exactly creates a confusion. Like, you can fit into the system if you are loyal, even if you are gay. But at the same time, if you are gay, we can use this information about you to out you and to make your life miserable. And it puts you into a constant search for the safe zone for yourself. And it's not only about queer people, but it's the very apparatus, the very structure is built and designed in such a way that your life is an endless run in order to fit into some proposal from the from the leader, from the criminal. And it's a vicious circle. It's never ending game. And the very beginning of the game is 2001, a little bit of historical perspective. It's not the beginning, but the end of the Republic of Belarus, actually. In 2001, the Constitutional Court and the Parliament was practically, physically destroyed by the president, so-called president. Exactly in 2001, he received absolute power, and there was no other branch of power who could oppose him. And it was a long fight for 7 years, from 1994, when he was actually democratically elected for the very first and the last time in the history of Belarus. He was in war with Constitutional Court and with the parliament. And my teenage years, I was growing up as a homosexual teenager in the country where it was like really the burning field already. It was the land of no law as such. And the next events related to the elections and to any democratic improvements in my country, it was always a very bitter fight with no results and with absolutely meaningless even to try. That's what I started feeling as a teenager. And kind of those waves of repressions, where the last wave was in 2020 and it's not yet finished, they were happening every election, basically. The amount of trauma is unbearable. It's just always there. And I just wanted to kind of try to come back to this teenage years of mine, when I was actually, as a gay boy and gay teenager, I was quite happy. There was a lot of entertainment I had, a lot of people were around, and everybody was still relaxed and we enjoyed each other. And I'm wondering if it's the same now after this whole crisis we survived, and especially people who stayed there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of important to understand that while you live in Belarus, it is so normalized of what is happening there. I think that if you don't travel, and now you actually cannot. So, coming back to a question, how is it for queer teenagers right now. Like when I was a teenager, the relations between the European Union and Belarus were quite all right. So it was possible to travel all across Europe if you had money. It was possible to go and apply for a tourist visa. And you could go basically wherever you wanted to go in Europe. I mean, when I was 18, I quite vividly remember that. That was the first time I traveled by myself. And I bought, I don't know, 10 euro ticket from Vilnius to Barcelona. And that was my first experience of, you know, being out there in a completely different country, in a completely different land. And I don't think that that's possible anymore. So when we think about how it was for me to grow up, I think like my privileges related to the economic status coming from a family that has been initially very democratic and liberal. During my teenage years, I didn't really encounter any type of difficulties. I wasn't public about my sexuality or about my gender identity, and that was one of the reasons why I haven't encountered any type of discrimination. I wasn't engaged in political or civil rights activism. Like, I was very invisible to the whole society. So then in my very closed circle of friends and closed circle of family, it was fine. Like, no one really questioned me. But I think the difficulty here is that while you grow up, you learn to self-censor. So you know, for example, that when you don't talk about your sexuality or gender identity, no one will discriminate you. So you kind of internalize that. Mm-hmm. And instead of questioning whether that's actually that's an okay practice to be only safe while you play alone with heterosexual and cisgender people, you internalize that and instead you self-censor. So you, for example, you monitor how you talk about yourself, how you talk about your beloved ones, you monitor how you talk about your relationship with others and so on. And you are in safety while you do all of that. But you really pay a very high price later when this whole process of very hard self-censorship is so internalized that later on in life, you can't even imagine how to be out again. So, you know, I think like it's important to kind of understand that, you know, while for me, like when I was growing up, it was quite all right. Later, when I started to engage like in political and civil rights activism, I instantly was encountered by different degrees of both homophobia, transphobia, sexism, and misogynia, like all of that at once. And I think that that's can serve as an example of how it is to be in Belarus. So while you are in this very non-political close circle of people whom you trust, you can be sort of safer. But once you decide to do something else, then you start to experience a lot of difficulties.
Well, that's a very nice link in between the political system and all these social structures existing in the country to this very personal experience we have. And I'm just fascinated about exactly this paternalistic proposal that obviously works quite well. Mm-hmm. It's also important to observe yourself in the existing social, cultural, and political landscape. And I would also say that my generation is the result of the previous global disaster. For the West, the fall of the Berlin Wall became a symbol of freedom, became a symbol of reborn, of all the values we were longing for so many years, and now it's there. And the fact that on the other side of the Berlin Wall, actually the progress was not yet achieved at all, but we were living in already globalized world. So we kind of inherited or inhaled or internalized the values related to the new world after the Cold War, but it never happened to us in practice. So the reality and the image was completely not fitting together.
You are listening to a special English edition of Quirilka podcast, supported by LGBTQfundingcircle.org, a British grassroots initiative who is currently building a network of activists around the globe fighting for equality. You can visit their website to become a part of the circle, to make a donation, to become a volunteer, or to find out more about what they do.
What is Belarus? The country of nowhere, the country of someone who is struggling for freedom. We have a very specific perception in the Western gaze as fighters for democracy, for instance. And the nation of being as unlucky as to have a huge common border with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
What is then the difference between Russia and Belarus? What is the nature of this ideological conflict we are having? Why didn't we achieve democracy already? Why was it not possible before? Those questions are crucial for me to reflect on. And I would also say it's important for me to explain a little bit the historical and cultural development of this dependency on Russia and Russian domination in my country. It didn't come out of a sudden. It has been already 200 years of very strong pressure from the Russian Empire and the process of erasing everything which is not Russian enough, transforming everything which is Belarusian into look and sound more Russian-like. It's our invisible fight we are having in the frames of our identities and national identity as such. And I think it's just important to know that actually there was never such a country as Russia until the early 18th century. It was always called Moscovia. And there was another country with the name of Rus, and it was about Kyiv, which is now Ukraine. And it was a very long ongoing fight. And so eventually Moscovia got more influence, got more power, also thanks to the close ties with Golden Horde. The point is, they needed to have the name of the older culture in order to prove that they have the rights to assimilate it, to expand their influence there, using the name. What I find interesting is that Belarus, it's not the really authentic name. The name is artificially produced, or it became a result of multiple processes happening. And one of the processes was also when our territory was conquered by Russia, by Moscovia back then, it was important to call us with this element of Rus. For them, and as I also mentioned before, Rus was a very old name of Kievan Rus. So it's a very interesting synthesis in which kind of now Russian propaganda is using also this historical fakes which have been produced by Catherine the Great. They need to prove that they have the right on all the land around them. And that's also the reason why the full-scale invasion in Ukraine happened. And at the same time, the name of Rus is much more older and authentic than Russia itself. And it gives me a very interesting feeling of my identity is hybrid and flexible and fluid, talking about what Belarus is. And we are under pressure from imperialistic forces. And at the same time, I find this image romantic. So we are actually holding some authentic roots inside our identity. And at the same time, we are struggling with the oppression and with the empire who wants to just expand their influence. And this is something for me very special. I respect my roots. I would like to know more about my culture. And at the same time, I don't want to prove that I'm superior. And that's what I also like about Belarus. We actually never expanded our land in this very colonial terms. We never had colonies, right?
We did during the Greatest Duchy of Lithuania.
Well, but it was not colony.
The colonies. We colonized.
Zamoytia. No, Zamoytia and Kyiv was territories with autonomy.
Well, but, I mean, the colonies do have some autonomy.
Okay, we were not so cruel as colonizers.
Okay. Nah, I mean, I'm not sure that I'm like 100% on board with that. I find it like very problematic, the whole essentialization of history, like saying that there were some lands that have these natural and authentic roots and then the others that were colonized. I mean, it is almost not possible right now to come back to any type of historic moment when the colonization was not happening. Like Belarus, due to its geopolitical location in Europe, has been always a part of something. It has been a part of the Great Duchies of Lithuania. It has been a part of Poland. It has been a part of the Russian Empire. So it always has been as a part of other greater entities, which typically dominated the land by the force. So I think, like, for me, it's very needed to recognize that Belarus is the result of these very different political and armed forces who have shaped, like in a very literal way, the territory of the country. So the lands that are currently are supposed to be called Belarus, those were decided when the Soviet Union has fallen. And that is, for example, why Smolensk, which initially was a Belarusian city, was not included in Belarus, and now it's a part of Russia. Or Vilnia, who has been the capital of Belarus for so many years, was now part of Lithuania.
That's what exactly my point is. Typically, all the empires and all the nation states who pretend to be the to inherit all this colonial power into their current territories, for instance, and the same is fair in regards to the Great Britain and to regards to Russia, to Germany. But in our case, exactly so many powers influenced the shaping of our also not only land, but also the mentality and the identity. And we were never the leading force in any of empires we took part in. We were parts of empires, but we never dominated other nations in the frames of our empire. This is maybe just a little bit of a romantic perspective. I think we are not pretentious at all, because we don't need to prove anything to anyone, but we need just to find peace with ourselves.
I'm not entirely kind of convinced with that. As we see right now, there is a whole uprise of Belarusian conservatives who exactly claim that Belarus used to have this great past and this past glory that we need to revive again. So then for me, that's really a little bit more kind of nuanced and problematized, because I don't really think that there is this common we, which is neutral in Belarusian context. I think right now we see that very, very clearly, especially after 2020 elections and the whole democratic process that was after that and the repressions, that in Belarus there are multiple groups with political interests, and they very differently interpret both the Belarusian history but also the current Belarusian present. Mm-hmm. And it is very much right now up to interpretation how Belarus was 3 centuries ago and how it is now. I also feel that, you know, this collective identity of we, I'm not entirely sure, you know, how to identify that. Like, Belarus has been populated by so many ethnic communities and so many ethnic groups, which were sometimes forcefully eliminated by the USSR. Some of the largest communities, such as the Jewish community of Belarus, has been exterminated by the Nazi power when Belarus was occupied by the Nazi forces. So for me, it's really, right now, especially when it comes to talking about the Russian full-scale invasion in Ukraine, there is a tendency to try to simplify what is happening and try to show, yeah, like there are bad guys, which are the Russians, and then there are good guys, which are the Ukrainians, and then there are like this mid person, this medieval actor, which Belarus is. And I think that doesn't really reflect on the complexity and the history we have in that region, because I think people typically consider that the history of Belarus started with its independence in 1994 when the Soviet Union collapsed, while Belarus has like centuries and centuries of history of being a part of different political and geopolitical constellations. It has been by itself as the great Duchess of Lithuania. So I would say, like, for me, it's a bit more complex, and I'm not entirely sure that I can kind of 100% sign up that, you know, Belarusians were never wanted to conquer the globe. Like, it was once when the great Duchess of Lithuania was from one sea to another sea, which they tell in school children still. And there are still people in Belarus who want to revive Belarus in that particular borders from the Black Sea up to the Baltic Sea.
Well, I would say that there is much more practical and meaningful and reasonable idea to establish the union in between the Baltic and the Black Seas, which will unite Latvia, Lithuania, Ukraine, Belarus, Poland. It's not about creating an empire, but building confederations. And I think which is fair about our history is that we were one of the first countries in Europe to really implement noble democracy. Like, it was not democracy of the people, but it was really the democracy of the nobilities.
Yep.
When it was the real voting process and position of the king was elected since 15th century. I mean, this says something about us. And also, if to just calculate the amount of time our current territory was under the authority of someone else means that we were colonized by someone else. It is quite an experience in the frames of European family. Like, we are the rare example of, I mean, maybe it's also about, I don't know, Czech Republic, for instance. Mm-hmm. Small nations that were struggling for survival in the situation when they were surrounded by huge and powerful empires, which is for me a sympathetic position for my consciousness, for instance. I don't know how would I have behaved in the situation of this colonial guilt. How can I change and deal with the consequences of my ancestors? And in my case, I have a little bit of a different perspective. I'm trying to fight for my own identity. Mm-hmm. And my consciousness is kind of clean, no? Mm.
I think when we say that Belarus was colonized, I don't think that I can fully agree with that, especially right now when there is so many discussions about the Russian Federation, whether that is the empire or not. I think there is a tendency to try to use the terms that originally were invented for a completely different context where colonization happened in like full scale and try to apply those to our context without really reflecting whether this concept fits. So, for example, when I talk about decolonization or colonization, those are all the concepts that were kind of developed by the scholars in the Latin America. And then right now, I think there is a tendency to try to simply take them from that particular context and reapply them to what is happening right now in Eastern Europe, which I don't think like is really apt to what is specifically happening. Because, you know, when we think in very academic explanation of what is colonization, Belarus hasn't been subjected to that. I mean, there has been a lot of influence by the Russian Empire to the land and to the people, to the culture and to the language, but it wasn't really colonization in a strict meaning of that particular word. And I think like it's important right now to talk about these nuances, specifically to highlight the complexity of politics in Eastern Europe. Because like when we say like, well, Belarus was colonized, then of course, it's much easier to understand, you know, Russia as the colonizer and Belarus as this kind of more or less objectified victim of colonization, which wasn't the truth. Belarus has been, and Belarusian people have been really struggling for independence and for autonomy, even with in the Russian Empire, yet kind of the imperialist power typically kind of killed all the political and the social and the civil rights struggle on that land. So then, you know, for me, like when we talk about Belarus, I think it's important to recognize that Russia has always been somewhere as this great actor of influence on what is happening in Belarus. And that has been especially true since 1994 when Belarus became independent. We can very clearly say that Belarus is now like politically, socially, culturally, economically is very dependent on Russia. And what is happening in Belarus is very much connected with whether the Russian state or the Russian so-called president are in agreement with the course of action that is happening in Belarus. But and yet to recognize that Belarus had autonomy in a lot of the decisions that were made, there was a struggle, and then it might not be the colonization what happened, but like some other process for which I don't have a term.
To be honest, I'm not getting the difference why actually you think Belarus had an autonomy in the frames of Russian Empire, because it was completely artificially introduced government. The whole governance was our nobilities were excluded out of it. It was only Russian dukes who were brought to our territory and they were ruling. And we had so many uprisings, so many people died to try to get rid of this. Why wouldn't it be called a colonization? In the 19th century, we were the very clearly a colony of Russia.
No, not really. No. I think like we really need to kind of have a deeper analysis of how colonization was formulated by the scholars of Latin America. Colonization as a process has these four characteristics. One of them is extraction of natural resources, which never happened in Belarus. Mm-hmm. So Belarus was never like industrially excavated by the Russian Empire because that was not of interest. A lot of natural resources that Belarus has, it still has. And now we're selling it to China and Russia. But like the excavation, which is one of the main part of colonization, has never happened in Belarus or in any of its territories. So, but it happened in Ukraine, for example, which is a very different story. So Russia and the Russian Empire have been industrially excavating resources, natural resources included, from Ukraine since, I don't know, 17th century. So, you know, in those terms, Ukraine has a very different relations with Russia as well. The second thing, when I talk about autonomy, for me, it's not about the decision making, but rather some sort of self-autonomy within the territories. I mean, of course, the Russian Empire, as it is an empire, had a lot of influence on, you know, how Belarus was ruled or not. Yet, for example, our nobility, in many cases, like, people were killed if they upraised, but a lot of Belarusian nobility actually survived 18th and 19th century. Some of them migrated to other countries, which is also not a trait of colonization, because colonization is typically associated with, like, full-scale excavation of culture. So typically it is associated with the language being banned, like the nobility, intelligence, scientific community, like people of arts being killed completely.
Which happened to us in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Stalinistic repression.
Exactly. Yeah. But that is like another process. So that is why I'm saying that we cannot really just take term out of context and say that that has happened, because I feel that that really, really simplifies mm-hmm. what happened in Belarus. Because whenever you say, like, well, Belarus has been a colony of Russia, I don't really think that that's what happened. And I think that that really plays to the simplification of how the West or Europe or the global North sees Belarus.
Mm-hmm.
And it really takes a lot of agency from us, because I think when we kind of state that Belarus was a colony, that's like a full stop. And then people understand that as they can. But I think, like, when we really try to tackle this political complexity of what has been happening in Belarus in, like, different period of times, as you said, like, the period when, like, the part of Belarus was annexed by the Russian Empire after Rzecz Pospolita was divided, that's one period of history. Then Belarus was occupied by the Soviet states, another period of history. Then, like, there was the Second World War, completely other thing, with a lot of national and / nationalistic processes happening in the country, a lot of struggles, a lot of fights for independence and so on. And then the whole political repressions by the USSR, you know, a lot of different things. And I think whenever we say that it was simply a colony all of the time, I really think that we miss the complexity of what has been happening in the country. Circling back to you, what you have been saying about LGBTQ rights and women's rights and how the specific position that Belarus has geopolitically, but also like geographically, how that has influenced on, you know, what has been happening with our communities in the country. I want maybe to share a little bit, as Belarus has been in such high dependency for the last 25 years, I think it's important to recognize that both the European Union, but also Russia, has shaped how we think about LGBTQ rights and how we think about women's rights. I mean, I still very vividly remember when I was younger and, you know, Makeout did their first Meta Festival in Minsk.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how long ago?
It was 2015.
Exactly, 2015. So then I feel back then it was absolutely okay. It was possible to organize a huge queer festival right in the city center, I don't know, 1 kilometer away from the residency of the president. And then 2 years later, it was not possible to organize even, I don't know, a self-support group all of a sudden, because, you know, the elections were held and the new cycle of political repression started. So then I feel that we have to recognize that there were these smaller instances when both LGBTQ activists and women's rights activists in Belarus could do some parts of the work, but then the cycle of repression always repeated itself and the opportunity window always closed later on.
And yeah, exactly, coming back to this paternalistic structure of the society, if you are fitting in, you might feel okay. And then if you want to step out of it, to go a little bit beyond this proposal, you are under threat. And so to speak, we have already 4 generations of LGBTQ activism in Belarus. And after 2020, it's vanished again and it's growing back. It's really like a biosphere. It's like a very complicated tropical garden. We are growing ourselves and then we are being washed away and it's invisible. It's also invisible for the Western gaze in particular, because there is no such a frame how to refer to it. Exactly. Was it a colonization that Belarus went through, or is it something else? How do we describe this civil society struggle in this very complex environment? I think also it's an academical issue, how to determine it. And we are constantly put as individuals in this very reality of balancing mm-hmm. on the edge of something. And this is a translocal experience. Like you are theoretically navigating yourself in the frames of the human rights concept in the country where there is no such a possibility as such, because there is no checks and balances, there is no democratical tools, there is no active citizenship participation tools. It's an authoritarian rule in the country. And how to survive? So we are sitting here and now, it's 2023. We are the survivors of the largest wave of repressions in our country since 100 years. Yep. I mean, I would easily compare what we experienced to Stalinistic repressions. The very level of terror, the very level of fear and devastation we are facing is pretty much the same.
I think whenever we're talking about LGBTQ rights or women's rights in Belarus, there is, I would say, a general perception from the global north that the human rights in Belarus are in decline. There is a lot of repressions happening. There is no observation of the law in the country. And typically it is like the whole situation is extremely bad for people. While I think when we have a closer look at how specific individuals perceive their life in Belarus, I don't really think that everyone would instantly say like, well, it was always extremely bad. I think based on Andrei's and my experience, it is quite clear that there were different periods in the country. Sometimes things were possible. There were other periods where the repressions were growing. And now, as we're in exile, it's a clear indicator, you know, that the last wave of repressions was extremely difficult, both on the civil society, but also specifically on LGBTQ organizers and women's rights organizers. So I wouldn't really say that, you know, it is that simple to say like, oh, well, all LGBTQ people in Belarus, they suffered so much and they're victims of the repressions and so on. I really think that we have to take a step back from this kind of objectification of how the experiences of LGBTQ people in Belarus are framed and understand the complexity of how, you know, different powers influenced on how the discourse around gender diversity and sexual orientation was formulated in the country, how different people and different actors were operating in the country, and how we as activists grew up in a quite complex environment where on the one hand, the European Union influenced a lot on how we perceived specific things, and then Russia had a lot to say on a variety of other things.
If to come back to the reality of here and now, Belarusian queer community is being divided at least into two parts. And basically, this is about your location. So both of us, me and Tony, are now in exile and we have no opportunities to come back home even for a short visit. Mm-hmm. It's quite risky and it will likely lead to some tension in between us and the system, and it will basically mean that we are stuck in prison for a while, as some of our colleagues and friends and people who were brave enough to just demand for the very basic right to have a vote and to be part of the democratic society. And for those of us who are still in Belarus, it's like a never-ending nightmare of anxiety. Even though we also mentioned this paternalistic offer, you can be any moment out of it and you can be detained for something you have done 3 years ago. And we know that every day Belarusians are being detained for just taking part in the protest in 2020, because the authorities are still monitoring all the pictures, all the footage that was produced back then. And it also divides us dramatically, because even normally the queer community of Belarus was non-homogeneous, because part of the community was quite okay also with this situation. And then there were people like us who are not satisfied with the existing system, and we were articulating the need for change. There is a lot of isolation in the air, and I feel quite lonely. I'm now being based in Berlin, and what I can do is to help other people who are living in the country to integrate into the new contexts. There is still a growing gap in between who is left and who is out of the country. And yeah, I feel quite miserable sometimes with this absence of meaning anymore, mm-hmm. because what I was fighting for is the change inside the country. And now it's kind of not relevant anymore. It doesn't mean anything. And then it takes a lot of efforts just to force yourself to move mm-hmm. forward, to continue doing at least something. And also struggling with the with the Belarusian agenda in the Western society is like how to prove that we still exist, that our lives still also matter, and to push this agenda forward. It's getting harder and harder, I think. And I also feel like we are all trying to win some time until this disaster is over. And only then maybe we can try to reestablish something again. And I am preparing myself for this moment when I will be finally able to say, okay, we can continue now. Because mm-hmm. when the huge catastrophe like the war is happening around, it feels like, yeah, you are very much disencouraged to focus on anything else but that. And of course, you feel a lot of inner struggles of prioritizing different issues. And then you are bringing your back to the very importance of the work you were doing and you should continue doing. Because for me, it was a crucial moment when in the frames of this full-scale invasion, the Russian leader started saying a lot about this family values they are having. And that's exactly they are fighting to preserve their perspective of the traditional values. And it puts me exactly back to my role. Like, yes, I'm fighting against this evil. And mm-hmm. I'm a soldier on this level of the war, which is the spiritual, ideological, cultural, the war of values in a way. At the same time, I'm quite a normal small subject, a normal human being with a very problematic, flexible, fluid identity. I mean, it's not problematic, it's just hard to be this subject because mm-hmm. it's quite uneasy to identify yourself and to identify the direction you are moving towards. And at the same time, you also realize that actually exactly those small soldiers in this cultural war are playing a crucial role in it. And it puts me into a position of like I'm overwhelmed with the actual amount of pressure and responsibilities and the very little amount of real influences that I can mm-hmm. make. And I think it's necessary to give yourself a lot of affirmations that, yeah, every single step you are doing is important and to encourage others to make those small steps.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still very much in connection with the community back in Belarus, and I have been working a lot with people who stay in the country. So then I feel that my position is actually a very a fortunate one, because like I can have access to the political spaces where I can be in like relatively safe mode of working in those spaces. I can meet with people and do things that potentially could be beneficial for Belarusians in country while kind of having this really high privilege of not being arrested or not being prosecuted, living like a life. However, I feel like, as you said, I think that the pressure to do something for the sake of people who are still in the country so high, it's really, really difficult to find yourself in any other role outside of this kind of resource for support for others. For me, it has been very difficult to kind of go back to feeling that I have my own priorities, I have my own ambitions, own ideas of what I want to do. It has been very much focused on others and what I can do for others, how I can help others and so on. In many ways, that's really kind of damaging to one's personality, because with time you start to see yourself as an instrument for others mm-hmm. rather than kind of understanding that you yourself have a say in what you should do and how you should do that. But I guess like as I've been so involved with like direct assistance since 2020 to a variety of different groups, it is, I would say, like the more you do that work, the more difficult it is to kind of put things on a hold and say like, okay, and now I will do something else that is more focused on my own needs. I think like the more you do this direct support, the more difficult it is to do something else.
Yeah, and it feels also like there is a specific dissonance between the normal NGO work in the Western countries and the role of an activist in and from Belarus. It's like a little bit of a different quality of motivation mm-hmm. as well. Like you work with something, with someone who is directly affected. You are directly affected. And at the same time, the structures you are having is almost zero. Just, yeah, maybe important to mention that as the result of the 2020s protest movement in Belarus, more than 2,000 NGOs were
liquidated,
closed, withdrawn from the country, and with many, many people being detained for their civil work, just with no reason. I mean, there is no state of law in this country anymore. So it's mostly done through the enormous amount of enthusiasm and energy you contribute from your inner deepest sources, the last maybe sources you are having, and then it leads to the very clear burnout cases mm-hmm. where there is nothing left and there is no more motivation and no more vision of the future. Yeah, and what would then be the solution? Exactly, bringing back to your own needs is definitely a strategy. The most important that you are okay. Whatever you do is relevant. Even without clear idea of what is Belarusian identity is, and we have at the moment and since long time quite a discussion in the independent cultural sphere, like what is actually our national idea, what is mm-hmm. actually our national identity. And I think our new challenge as Belarusians abroad is also to help shaping the image of us as unique subjects, even though it's not so easy to explain. And that's why I was stuck a little bit earlier in our conversation, like how exactly should I explain all the particularities, all the uniqueness of my background that I would be understood then?
So in case you have been listening to this podcast and then, you know, by the end of it, you are now at loss. So then what to do with the Belarusians you encounter and how to incorporate the knowledge about LGBTQ rights and LGBTQ people in Belarus into your own life? I would maybe suggest that whenever you feel that you, a person who doesn't really have experience of living in Eastern Europe, want to understand better of how those experiences were shaped, how was it for people to live in Eastern Europe or that? I don't know, in Belarus, in Ukraine, in Russia. My suggestion would be to start really reflecting on, well, how was it for you to live in the Western Europe or in the global North? How your experience were shaped by the political and the cultural powers in your own country? And then based on that experience, you will be able to start formulate the questions which potentially will not be so objectifying people and kind of really trying to understand that the similarities are there, but there are also a lot of differences between us, a lot of differences between our political context and cultural context. And in order to kind of understand a bit more how those differences influenced on us, my suggestion would be to really listen to people and learn more both about the politics but also about the history of the countries that we inhabit. Because as Andrea and I have been talking this whole time, this is like really a very complex historic process of how a variety of different things that were happening influenced our life back at home.
This podcast is brought together by Tony Lashton, Andrei Zavali, and Albert, aka Scarlett. Please feel free to contact us. We are excited to receive your feedback. Stay tuned, listen to other episodes of our podcast, tell your friends about us, and we wish you the very best, pederesque, queerish, faggotish day.